This is Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you on WPTF, AM 680, and WPTF.com. Joined by Mary Lucas from Transitions Life Care, here's your host, Jason Kong.
Welcome to Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you, a service of Transitions Life Care. It's your life, your care on FM 98.5, AM 680, WPTF, news, talk, traffic. Thank you so much for being here with us this afternoon. I am Jason Kong, here as always with Mary Lucas, who represents Transitions Life Care. Mary, how are you doing today?
Doing well. It's summer. Hot.
It is hot. You know, any news from the garden? I know we were switching things up this year.
Yeah, blueberries. I have blueberries. They're okay. Not quite ready yet, but hopefully I can come in with a haul soon, and we can have blueberries on the show. But if the birds don't eat them or the dogs don't eat them, both are fair game. The dogs have found out where they're at, and they're just on the other side of my fence, and they can see them through the fence, and they can also smell them. They're close enough to the fence. They're kind of like right there, and they know where they're at.
My wife has a killer blueberry bramble recipe, so no
yes.
pressure. No
okay,
pressure
all right.
On delivery here.
All right, I like that.
We're anxiously awaiting a new update from the blueberries in the garden. All right, well, let's get to the serious subject at hand, and we're going to be discussing all things related to our brain and caring for our brain, and we're so pleased to have on the show today Dr. Karen Sullivan, who is a board-certified neuropsychologist. Dr. Sullivan, thanks so much for being on the program today.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
I am really excited about this show. Brain health is something that's near and dear to me as my grandmother passed from Alzheimer's, and it's something we talk a lot about in our family. Actually, just a couple days ago, there was an article that came out in the news about how it's genetic, and my brother and I were talking about it, and so it's something we're always – it's top of mind for us, no pun intended.
Oh, sure.
Before we get started, Dr. Sullivan, tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and what got you into this work.
Sure. Well, you mentioned your grandmother. It's the exact same for me. I think so many of us who've had an up-close personal encounter with any of the dementias are really changed by it. And so seeing her go through Alzheimer's disease when I was a teenager really made a lasting impact on me. And so I've been in the brain health field since I was about 14 and a caregiver all the way up through, you know, graduate school, and now own my own practice down here in Pinehurst, and working for our local healthcare system to try to create a person-centered dementia care pathway to hopefully move the needle a little bit on whole person care.
That's I love your idea right here around whole person care. And before we dive into everything, how would you define whole person care? That can be a complicated one. How would you define that?
Yeah, I think it is making sure the person is the first and foremost focus, and then the brain disease is second. Much too often, people are just getting a very medicalized approach to brain health challenges, with forgetting that, you know, the brain, of course, is just an organ of the self. You know, we are not our brains. We're much more than that. So we make sure that we're not referring to people as, you know, the Alzheimer's patient, or we're forgetting that they're going to have a psychological adjustment to their condition and there's going to be a social impact. So we're not only just trying to take it from a holistic body perspective, because, you know, you can have other health conditions that worsen dementia, diabetes, high blood pressure, those kind of things. That's kind of your standard whole person approach. But neuropsychologically, we want to make sure we're really including, you know, the person's emotional self, their social self, you know, even their spiritual self, all the things that are meaningful and make that person uniquely who they are.
I think that's important to think about. You mentioned she has Alzheimer's, but it's to me, and I've had this conversation with a few people in our industry, of you're living with dementia, or you're living with Alzheimer's. It's not she has Alzheimer's or he has dementia. It's you're living with those.
Oh, absolutely. And we do that with a lot of brain health challenges. You still hear people say, you know, a stroke victim, you know, and it's like people aren't their diagnosis. And we want to make sure, you know, Jean stays Jean and she doesn't just become that Alzheimer's victim, that person. And how we, you know, our philosophy of care really trickles down to how people with dementia get cared for. And I think that's why it's really so important to try to get people better educated, and really people just need more skills. I think a lot of people have a heart for wanting to engage and connect with people with dementia, but we just don't have accessible enough training for people to know exactly how to kind of speak the language of dementia and have more positive interactions with our folks with dementia.
So you've used this big word a few times here, neuropsychologist, and we were laughing a little bit before the show to I don't know if I've had enough coffee to say it. It's kind of a tongue twister for me to get it all out. But what is a neuropsychologist?
Yeah, I like to say we're the your brain's best friend you never knew that you needed. We really focus on diagnostics, so we are really the experts to go to when somebody is concerned there may be one of the dementias, and we are able, through paper and pencil testing, clinical interviews, and review of medical records, to determine, is it normal aging? Could it be something like mild cognitive impairment? Is it dementia? And if it's dementia, then we're very good at getting clear on what are the contributing factors to that dementia. And the reason all of that matters so much is that's what allows for personalized brain health care. Because if we make the mistake of just saying dementia, we lose an opportunity to potentially treat the specific disease that's causing that person's dementia. So I would say we're really the best in healthcare at diagnosing the subtypes of dementia. We work closely with our partners in neurology, of course, and primary care and palliative care, but we're really the people that folks go to when they need a clear diagnostic understanding. Some of us also do treatment too, because we are really well positioned to understand the impact of the brain health challenge, like on the person or on the family. So I spend a little bit of my time doing kind of one-on-one counseling, helping people, you know, adjust and just talk about. Sometimes there's grief that goes along with these diagnoses. Other people treat them a little bit different. And so we like to just hold space to validate that that is part of having a neurological condition, and try to support people through that, so it's not an added layer of disability on top of the neurological change.
What aspects, as a neuropsychologist, what aspects do you feel or see in the practice that you do most beneficial to your patients?
I think it's really relational. I think that's one of the things that I love so much about what I get to do is our assessments are typically between 4 and 5 hours.
Wow.
So we do an hour-long clinical interview. We do about 3 hours of cognitive paper and pencil testing, and then we do an hour feedback. So patients seem to really appreciate the fact that we are taking this bird's eye view, and we're able to, you know, really have the time to look back at hospital records from 2 years ago, and maybe that's a factor. And, you know, I think a lot of people are becoming more and more dissatisfied with healthcare because it's so quick. You know, follow-up appointments are typically 6 to 8 minutes. So I think when we are able to spend the time, it gives us a much more comprehensive view, but also it allows people to open up and share things with us that maybe they're very anxious about. That's one of the biggest barriers in an early and accurate diagnosis for dementia, is we still have a lot of stigma, and we're still really getting people to a diagnosis much too late. And especially now with the new infusion drugs that we have for Alzheimer's disease, earlier is really necessary to have a significant impact. So a lot of the work I'm doing through my Reed Fellowship down here at First Health of the Carolinas is trying to talk to the community about what are some of the earliest signs and what should you say to your primary care to initiate a gold standard evaluation. So you can, you know, if something's happening in your brain, it's happening whether or not we call a spade a spade. But you're going to be much more in control if you know what's happening earlier.
It's funny that you mentioned the 6 minute primary care appointment or 6 minute doctor appointment. I was just talking to someone last night about, oh, I need to go get my mole scan before, I always do it right before summer so I don't get judged about this amount of sunscreen I wear by my dermatologist. But we were laughing. It's like, yeah, but that's like a 2 minute scan. What are they really finding in 2 minutes? And it's like, yeah, you know, what are they really finding in like the 2 minutes they look at me? Oh, there's a mole. But it's like I love the relationship and the aspect of that in your work. Because that's a big thing in learning more about people and their brains. You can't just look at someone for 10 minutes and say, oh, yeah, and then pass it on. It's a lot more than that in the work that you do.
Yeah, and I think that the brain is really different, and it should be special, and it should be approached in a more humanistic way. And so one of the things that we know is that older folks are extremely anxious about dementia, and people know that they get kind of othered once they're given that label. And so if I just, in a very cold, quick way, start saying things like, you know, what do you think about memory? Are you worried maybe this is what happened to your mom is going to happen to you? You're much less likely to actually get the truth, as opposed to even spending, you know, 1 to 2 minutes just finding some common human ground. Oh, hey, I'm from New Jersey. Oh, wow, mm-hmm. I used to vacation there. You know, you're just starting mm-hmm. off saying, like, we are two people here together. We have to establish trust so we can have an honest conversation. So I have truth that I can work with, and then I can really help you. But I think these things are so scary for people that having that relational start is definitely part of the magic. Mm-hmm.
We are speaking with Dr. Karen Sullivan, who is a board-certified neuropsychologist, and we're talking about caring for your brain, and we're going to continue our conversation with her right after this. You're listening to Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you, a service of Transitions Life Care. It's your life, your care on FM 98.5, AM 680, WPTF, news, talk, traffic.
This is Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you on WPTF, AM 680, and WPTF.com. With your hosts, Mary Lucas and Jason Kong.
Welcome back to Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you, a service of Transitions Life Care. It's your life, your care on FM 98.5, AM 680, WPTF, news, talk, traffic. Jason Kong here with Mary Lucas. Our guest with us today is Dr. Karen Sullivan, who is a board-certified neuropsychologist, and we are talking all things about our brains and caring for our brain. And Mary, I think we sort of broached this subject a little bit, but we want to dive into more on brain fitness, because I think this is something that we're all kind of somewhat aware of, but mm-hmm. I don't think we exactly know what that means and what we should be doing.
Exactly. Dr. Sullivan, we talked a little bit in the show about, you know, there's all this media out there. There's a lot of information. There's a lot of misinformation about brain health and preventing dementia. Talk to us a little bit about what brain fitness is. What is the problem in your experiences as a clinician helping your patients navigate this?
Sure. Yeah. Brain fitness industry is kind of why I actually started my public outreach education program called I Care for Your Brain, because I honestly got so fed up with hearing people wasting their money, their time, their hope on these supplements or brain games. These are $8 to $10 billion a year in revenue for these companies, and they really have no evidence base. There's no scientific information that any over-the-counter drug can enhance brain health, except if you have a vitamin deficiency. So if you do have a vitamin B12 deficiency, of course, you can go to your drugstore and get that, and that will help your brain. Mm. But that none of these, you know, memory power, and in fact, the most popular one, Prevagen, has been sued multiple times by the federal government for marketing fraud. And so I just kept seeing more and more patients coming in, really banking on these pills to kind of be the end-all be-all. Not only I won't get dementia, but I'm going to give it to my wife because it's going to reverse dementia. So what was difficult for me is that I knew that there was this world of science-based brain health recommendations that is written about in scientific journals, you know, that I had learned about throughout my graduate training, but not enough people knew about that stuff. And so mm-hmm. where that really falls is in this world of modifiable risk factors. So many of us have a family history of someone with dementia. And typically what that means is we will have a genetic variant in our DNA that does increase our risk of developing one of the subtypes of dementia. But it takes something in our environment, in our lifestyle, in our behavior, in our daily choices that interacts with that genetic predisposition to turn on the gene. So I spend a lot of time going around talking about these modifiable risk factors, because that's really where our power comes from. We can make changes that will reduce variability in blood pressure, that will keep blood glucose more steady. We can eat a whole foods diet. We can move our body more. We can be less lonely. Those are things that actually will improve your brain health, not something you're going to get over the counter at a Walgreens.
You know, there are a lot of popular and fad diets out there. I mean, the new fasting thing is bizarre to me, too. Like, is that really helping you to not eat for half of a day? For me, I would just be hangry. But there's
nobody wants that.
No, nobody wants that. And no one wants to deal with me fasting either. But there are a lot of these popular and fad diets out there that tout the benefits for brain health. Is there really a specific diet or a specific thing you should be eating that could help your brain? Or what other things should you consider limiting? I see a lot about alcohol. What's the reality behind this?
Yeah, this is a great topic. I get this question a lot. Well, I like that you were talking about blueberries before, because of course, everybody knows they're good for the brain. There is actually one diet. We kind of think of it more like a lifestyle, not so much a diet, because you're right. There's a lot of marketing dollars that get spent on, you know, eat this food product and it's going to help your brain. But the MIND diet, which is an acronym for Mediterranean Intervention for Neurodegenerative Delay, is really the only evidence-based way of eating that we know reduces the risk of dementia. And what I like about it is it's very practical. It's basically a combination of the Mediterranean diet and the DASH diet. Mm-hmm. And it's flexible. It allows for, you know, special events. It's nothing restrictive. It's really kind of trying to eat these healthy fats and lean proteins and a lot of leafy greens and fresh fruit, you know, but it does allow for, you know, a little butter here and there. I think you're allowed one or two pastries a week, which of course, you know, is always a good thing. But even in people who didn't follow the MIND diet very strictly, we still see a very robust reduction in the prevalence of dementia in those folks. So the more strongly you follow the MIND diet, the more power you have over reducing your risk of dementia. And it's pretty powerful. It gets up there between 30% and 40%. So that's pretty influential.
Wow, that is very impressive. I need to think about this a little bit more. My age now, and I know there's a lot of us out there that do. I was talking to my mom the other day of like, am I allowed to have this glass of wine right now? I shouldn't be having a glass of wine on a weekday, but I think in one of those quote diets or lifestyles, it's okay to have a glass of wine every now and then.
Yeah, alcohol is an interesting one, because what we've known for a long time is that, or what we've believed for a long time, I should say, is that people who drank a small amount of alcohol per day tended to have healthier brains than people who either didn't drink any alcohol or who drank more than 2 to 3 glasses a day. So we used to think 1 a day, 7 a week was actually a brain healthy habit. And the mechanism would be it opens blood vessels more. Mm. You can get more blood flow to your brain. Of course, neurons require glucose and oxygen to survive. And we used to think of it as what we call a J-shaped curve, again, meaning the people who had the one glass a day actually had a healthier brain than people who had none per day. And we used to think, you know, red wine, of course, and really the only benefit is probably those phytochemicals that give it, you know, maybe the purple color. There's a little added benefit there, but really any alcohol because of the way it opens blood vessels. But what we know now is that there was a little bit of foul play going on with some of that data, and some people who owned wineries were behind that word about wine. Yeah. So then we kind of changed it to, hey, it should just be more like whatever alcohol you like. But in the last year or two, there have been some studies that are pretty compelling that have come out that have really pushed this idea that any amount of alcohol is neurotoxic. Mm. I think it's probably very complicated. And a lot of it, too, depends on other aspects of your health. So I think that's one thing we're very clear on in the modern day understanding of brain health, is that it is whole person health. It's not going to be just, you know, eating a certain way or drinking a certain thing. It's going to be body. It's going to be social. It's going to be your stress level. So overdoing it in one area is never going to be a realistic way to get a healthy brain. You have to really make deposits in your brain bank in all different ways. That's we're very clear on that brain health requires a very multi-pronged approach.
So before we go to our break, I want to touch on what is your I Care for Your Brain program and then dive into it a little bit more in our next segment. So what is I Care for Your Brain?
Yeah, something I started about 6 or 7 years ago now, and I've done it in person in North and South Carolina, just going to groups of people, talking about what power they have over their brain health. And then on YouTube, every week for that time, I've done a free brain health lecture, really just trying to get science-based whole person brain care to the public. And it's great because social media is free on both sides. And so we're almost touching 100,000 subscribers on YouTube. And it's so satisfying because there's a lot of folks around the world who have had, you know, a stroke or dementia who have never even been able to go to the hospital or understand from a neuropsychologist how we think of their injury or what might be some ways that they can recover better. So it's really been this great mechanism to get to touch people across the globe with hopefully a, you know, objective science-based approach to brain health care. Winds up being something that, you know, companies are very interested in having me come and talk because the workforce, you know, majority of people now are between 30 and 60. They have a parent who had some type of dementia and they are very aware of not wanting to have that same fate. So I think there's kind of a middle-aged group that's very motivated to adhere to these evidence-based recommendations earlier. You know, we're really prioritizing brain health as more relevant across the lifespan and not just something we should be concerned about once we have gray hair, which is great. You know, so I have a lot of folks in their 30s, 40s, and 50s who come to see me or come to some of my talks, and they really want to take control of their brain health, but they're just not sure what to do because I think people have a sense that, you know, these cookbooks that say, well, we can reverse Alzheimer's or, you know, take this memory blaster pill. People kind of know it can't possibly be real. they don't really have a lot of faith in it. So in the I Care for Your Brain program, I'm just trying to be a trustworthy source of information for people.
Something that we all need. We want to hear more about I Care for Your Brain from Dr. Karen Sullivan, who's a board-certified neuropsychologist, and we are going to hear more right after this. Stick around. You're listening to Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you, a service of Transitions Life Care. It's your life, your care, on FM 98.5, AM 680, WPTF, news, talk, traffic.
This is Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you on WPTF, AM 680, and WPTF.com. 60 minutes devoted to giving you all the information you need when caring for a loved one with Mary Lucas and Jason Kong. If you have questions for the show, you can email agingmatters@transitionslifecare.org.
You're listening to Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you, a service of Transitions Life Care. It's your life, your care on FM 98.5, AM 680, WPTF, news, talk, traffic. Hey, if you want to learn more about Transitions Life Care, view their resources, you can go online to transitionslifecare.org, transitionslifecare.org. I'm Jason Kong here with Mary Lucas. Our guest on the line is Dr. Karen Sullivan, who is a board-certified neuropsychologist, and we are talking about brain health and caring for your brain. And Mary, I'm a little worried right now
because
both you and Dr. Sullivan are very passionate about palliative care, and we're going to get into a discussion about palliative care. And I've had to like sort of rein you two in during the break because you two are just so excited to talk about this. So, but let's get into it. You've got 10 minutes on the clock. Let's go.
Okay, ready to go. This show. We record the show, and it's, you know, 10-minute segments. No one knows what happens during the break and how long we could go on. Who knows how long that this actually took to record? We don't know. But I'm excited to talk about palliative care. It's something I'm passionate about. Dr. Sullivan, there is a lot of confusion around palliative care. First of all, it's a very weird word. Talk to us first. What is palliative care? What is it not? And what are you all doing with palliative care?
Sure. So I think of palliative care as chronic care, really a natural partner for whole person care, because I don't know, the folks who seem to gravitate towards palliative care seem to just have these enormous hearts and incredible interpersonal skills. Mm-hmm. So what we did down here at the First Help of the Carolina system is we analyzed who in the healthcare system was seeing the most folks who have been diagnosed with dementia. And it was very clear very early on that palliative actually serves this population the most. So when we started to really wrap our heads around the supply and demand issue of dementia and the fact that we have an aging population and we have, you know, more and more wait time to see brain health specialists like myself and neurology, it became really evident, not just down here in the Sand Hills, but this is a national problem, that we really needed to redistribute brain health expertise across the healthcare system. So it's not really going to continue to work to have people just do these very simple cognitive screens in primary care and then be sent to a specialist. Right now in North Carolina, it will take you about 6 months to see a brain health specialist. And if nothing changes, they're estimating in a few years, we could actually be waiting 2 years for a neurology or a neuropsychology appointment. And I think we all agree that is not acceptable, especially based on this concept that time is brain. Early and accurate brain health diagnoses are just so important. So we are very lucky in my community down here in Moore County to get tremendous support from the foundation of First Health. So we have a very generous community and have an incredible philanthropical touch in our community. And so I was very honored this year to be awarded the very first Reed Healthcare Transformation Fellowship, which really gives me a lot of freedom to develop a person-centered dementia care pathway in our community. So right now we're really working in two directions. We're trying to do some innovative, amazing things within First Health of the Carolinas and Pinehurst Medical Clinic, where we're going to standardize cognitive screens. We're going to try to make sure everybody is getting maximum assessment for treatable conditions, make sure primary care and palliative folks are very, very educated about person-centered cognitive care, and really try to think about the moment someone interacts with the healthcare system all the way through to the hospice journey, how can we personalize that more and more? Because we know that there is excess disability in dementia care. It's not just a neurological condition. Like we said, we really need to impart skills and knowledge to direct care workers to be able to increase the quality of care for folks with dementia. And then we have a community program kind of going in the other direction called the Engaged Brains Project that I will be able to talk about more in a few months, but it's actually going to be a joining together of my I Care for Your Brain program and a woman named Tipa Snow's program. Mm-hmm. She does something called Positive Approach to Care. So Tipa and her team and me and my team, we're going to get together. I think we're the two most vocal person-centered dementia advocates in North Carolina. We're going to pool our resources and our bandwidth, and we're going to try to really make a difference with our program. So down here in Moore County, we're going to try to get 50 community champions trained in Tipa Snow's Positive Approach to Care. And then each of those 50 people is going to mentor 5 people in their specific sector. So we've got law, the arts, we've got grocery stores, we've got EMS, we've got nurse providers. I mean, we've really covered the entire community. Each community champion will mentor 5 people over the year, and we're all going to do an impact project. And the impact project is just to try to get us some momentum with this person-centered care movement. So we're going to be doing things like writing protocols for local banks to try to protect folks with dementia from financial exploitation. We're going to be coming up with trainings for police if they get called out on a dementia call. You know, what would be a way of handling it? Right now, there's a lot of stress that goes along with trying to manage these behavior symptoms. So when we train people in positive approach to care, we actually give them a language to speak. So we are approaching the person with dementia in a more humane way. And hopefully we can avoid things like over-medication and institutionalization of folks with dementia, try to keep them home and happy longer.
That is really interesting. I was actually talking, well, first of all, we've had Tipa on the show before, and now I'm like, now we need a Dr. Sullivan Tipa show to talk about this. And let's do this together.
We're going to launch it next month, so please have us back. We would love to.
Okay, I'm typing right now, so I remind myself later when I get off the show. Tipa's been a guest a couple of times, and I actually, we had Tipa on campus at Transitions Life Care not that long ago to do a training for some of the assisted livings in our area, and it was a great program. We had a little dinner, and she did a wonderful job. So I'm super excited to have a joint show. I'm going to pitch this with her, and hopefully we can have you back on and talk about that program. I think it's super important. I was talking to another organization across the country a couple weeks ago, and about their partnership with the emergency medical services in their area, and they had a grant to help frequent flyers that call into the EMS all the time. And it's not necessarily the person living with dementia calling in, but it's the caregiver in crisis who is exhausted and just doesn't know what to do. And I think that your program would be wonderful to help lighten the load on our EMS system and work with our law enforcement to help improve that.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, we actually have a sheriff's deputy down here in Moore County, Mrs. Victoria Price, who's going to be a part of our Engaged Brains project. And she is the one who is in charge of the training to go out and respond to these so-called behavior calls. So the footprint that I think we're going to be able to spread through our community, what we're really hoping is, it's an ambitious goal, but we're really trying to set an example for the world when community and philanthropy come together. That's how we're really going to move the needle on care. And, you know, the truth is it takes resources. It takes money. A lot of people know we need more support and more resources and supplies, but, you know, everyone's stretching a dollar and budgets are tight. So we're incredibly lucky down in this area through the foundation of First Health to be able to have programs that are the right thing to do that really do help, but, you know, take resources. So one other thing I'd just like to get this out there, because it's so important for everybody to appreciate the power of music as medicine in dementia care. So one of the things we're going to be able to do through the project, through a generous community donor, is every memory care resident in Moore County is going to be given personalized music. And we're going to be able to look at the public health analytics through First Health of the Carolinas and see what is the impact of that on our community health. So what we're predicting is we should have less emergency room visits. We should be prescribing less antipsychotics. We should really be able to try to engage and connect with people with dementia through the power of music. So we're really trying to do some innovative stuff down here, and we're going to track it over the course of a year, and then we're going to be able to pull analytics from the healthcare system, and hopefully we're going to be able to prove that these person-centered interventions actually work.
That is fascinating and really exciting, too, because I think everyone would sign up for those outcomes that you mentioned there. We're speaking with Dr. Karen Sullivan, who is a board-certified neuropsychologist, and we're going to continue our conversation on caring for our brains right after this. You're listening to Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you, a service of Transitions Life Care. It's your life, your care, on FM 98.5, AM 680, WPTF. News, talk, traffic.
This is Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you on WPTF, AM 680, and WPTF.com. Joined by Mary Lucas from Transitions Life Care, here's your host, Jason Kong.
This is Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you, a service of Transitions Life Care. It's your life, your care on FM 98.5, AM 680, WPTF, news, talk, traffic. Jason Kong here with Mary Lucas. We are talking all things about our brains and caring for our brains with Dr. Karen Sullivan, who is a board-certified neuropsychologist. And Mary, it's our final segment here, and I know we want to get into a discussion on research and what's out there in terms of what could be changing in the future.
Yeah, there's a lot out there, and we're seeing it in the news, and I'm also seeing it's very expensive in the news, and people talking about the accessibility to some of these treatments and advances in care. Dr. Sullivan, can you talk to us a little bit about what you have seen out there, anything coming down the pike, or what can you you share your insights on with what's going on in the advances in care and the treatments for dementia and Alzheimer's?
Sure. I kind of put it into two camps. One is, I think, to call on a TIPA quote, is until there's a cure, there's care. So I'm very, very encouraged that person-centered care is becoming the norm. The Alzheimer's Association came out a few years ago saying that is the standard of care, that we really have to respect each person's individuality. So I love all of the advances that are happening there. But in a true medical sense, we've really never been in a better position specifically with Alzheimer's disease. So we do have the first disease-modifying drug in Leqembi, a monoclonal antibody infusion, which we've never had. All the other drugs, Aricept, Menda, they are symptomatic relief. They don't really get at the cause of the Alzheimer's disease. So what we know with Leqembi, even though it's a little bit of a bear in terms of, you mentioned the cost. So Medicare right now is the only insurance that covers it. And most people will have a secondary insurance company, and those secondary plans are not covering Leqembi. So at the very least, there's an access problem from maybe the copay standpoint. And then also folks who have any early onset subtypes of dementia who aren't Medicare eligible are also having to pay out of pocket if they want it. It's also quite time consuming. So the treatment protocol right now is about every 2 weeks indefinitely. So there's some talk that maybe, you know, we're trying to look at new versions of clinical trials where let's do it for 6 months, let's do it for a year. But right now the protocol is kind of for life. So that's quite the commitment. And we wish it worked a little bit more powerfully. It reduces decline by about 21 to 28%. So it's not reversing, it's not making anything better, and it's not stabilizing. So it's the best we have, but it's, you know, comes with quite a few risks, specifically of bleeding in the brain. But what makes it a very, very exciting drug is really the future of it. So I think, unfortunately, it's not going to help our current generation as much as we would like. But the promise of these drugs is that we are getting much better at being able to visualize through PET scans, through spinal taps, when people are starting to accumulate these amyloid proteins in the brain, which typically happens 2 to 3 decades before someone starts to show the signs of memory loss in Alzheimer's disease. So if we could intervene much earlier through those imaging techniques, and also probably we're going to be using genetic markers a lot more to see who's at risk. People are probably going to start to be scanned for Alzheimer's or given a spinal tap to look at cerebral spinal fluid, probably in their 40s. And so these Leqembis of the world are, that's where we're really hopeful maybe we will be able to get at a true impactful medication, maybe even a cure, is if we can see who's at risk, see when they're first starting to collect amyloid and intervene, then go into those proteins attached to them, be able to flush them through the body. So that way, because once amyloid builds, it really suffocates brain cells, and then we have death of networks of brain cells, and that's when we see the symptoms clinically. But we know there's kind of this iceberg effect happening for, like I said, I mean, 20 years typically, maybe even 30 years before symptoms are happening. So that's really when we need to intervene. So I think we're really at the beginning of a whole new era of being able to make a difference in that subtype of dementia, but I think we still have a little ways to go. Unfortunately,
there's hope then. There is a little bit of hope. I feel like there's people out there that need to be able to see the light, you know?
Yes. I think, though, to be honest, I think there's much more hope coming from the care perspective, because we already have training programs like TIPA SNOS Positive Care Program that we know improve outcomes. We know that we can reduce caregiver burnout. We know that we can reduce these behavior symptoms. We can improve other health metrics by the way that we interact with people with dementia. And we can start doing that now. It's just a matter of being skilled and undergoing the training. So that's why I think making training more accessible to, you know, all direct care workers should really have many, many hours of continuing education in person-centered dementia care. We really have a problem with, you know, the people who spend the most time with our folks with dementia are either unpaid caregivers or paid minimum wage, typically. And that's really a barrier to care, because you're not going to get people sticking around in positions that long, and typically they're not given a budget for education. Mm-hmm. So that is something within our grasp that we can start to change today. So that's where I really put my eggs in that basket, because it feels more immediate to me.
That is a really good point. As someone who has attended one of TIPA's trainings and similar trainings, I think it's so critical for our caregivers to have that training. I learned so much. I thought I knew how to, you know, as someone who helped caregive and has been in this industry, I thought I knew how to do it. And, you know, I thought I had empathy and understanding around a lot of it, but I learned so much. And it was very eye-opening of just hearing TIPA and watching the hands-on approach.
Yeah.
And
it
was very eye-opening.
Her approach is so experiential. So you're not just sitting there getting some like dry PowerPoint.
Right.
You're actually developing perceptual empathy. You're actually really understanding what it's like to walk in the shoes of somebody with dementia. And that's very powerful. And then there's these skills. And once you know how to do it, it's so beneficial for both the person and the care provider, mm-hmm. because now we don't feel helpless. We don't feel like we're reinventing the wheel every day. We have a philosophy of care that is guiding us to look for moments of transcendence and mm-hmm. moments of joy and ways to engage. And it's just so, so, so much better than the blank slate that most people are offered, that I'm really on a mission to help spread the word about her approach. I just think it's brilliant.
Love that. So you also have your own YouTube channel. I want to make sure that everyone knows how to find your information and all of the resources that you have out there. Tell us a little bit about how people can find you and your resources available.
Sure. So if you go on YouTube and you put in "I Care for Your Brain" with Dr. Sullivan, you'll find over 200 free evidence-based brain health lectures, pretty much on anything you can come up with. We also are offering master classes on there right now, which is a 9-part lecture series that are between an hour and 90 minutes each, where I go through the 9 pillars of brain health. So that's really focusing on the what can you do about it, reducing the modifiable risk factor. So a couple years ago, we went to Charlotte over 2 days and filmed about 20 hours worth of content. So that's up there, totally free, totally just waiting for people to benefit from it. You can also go on our website, which is icfyb.com, so icareforyourbrain.com, and we have all sorts of information on there. And I would love for people to start to follow what we're doing with the Engaged Brains Project through the Foundation of First Health Fellowship, because we know a lot of people out there are very motivated to want to make dementia care better, but they just aren't really sure where to focus or who to get in touch with to add to the chorus of people who are trying to make a difference. So if folks want to reach out to me about that project too, I would love that.
That's awesome. And for anyone who wants to sponsor Dr. Sullivan and I's new advocacy group based on the love of our grandmothers for those with dementia, living with dementia and Alzheimer's, I'm going to name it Meemaw's Mindful Advocates. If anyone wants to sponsor Meemaw's Mindful Advocates, please reach out to us. We are really excited about that group too.
Please.
That is awesome. Dr. Karen Sullivan, board certified neuropsychologist, thank you so much for your time today and for setting up a resource for so many people that is trustworthy and isn't motivated by some questionable tactics. So it's so cool to have a wonderful resource like this available to us. And again, the channel we can look for on YouTube. Can you give us that one more time, Dr. Sullivan?
Sure. It's I Care for Your Brain with Dr. Sullivan.
Perfect. I Care for Your Brain. The initials of those words will take you to her website, icfyb.com. That's going to do it for us today. We're out of time. On behalf of Mary Lucas, I'm Jason Kong. Thanking you so much for listening to Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you, a service of Transitions Life Care. It's your life, your care on FM 98.5. AM 680 WPTF News, Talk, Traffic. Have a wonderful day.
You've been listening to Aging Matters, care and comfort that surrounds you on WPTF AM 680 and WPTF.com. For more information, log on to transitionslifecare.org.